Welcome to True Crime Cat Lawyer. I'm your host, Elise, and sometimes my cat Winston joins me. This podcast contains content of a graphic nature that might not be suitable for all listeners, including descriptions of violence, sexual assault, and crimes against animals and children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, and welcome back to True Crime Cat Lawyer. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We've already covered a few cases this month, both of which centered around protection and restraining orders. In this week's episode, we're covering three cases that highlight another sub-issue of domestic violence cases. All three of our victims were killed by their partner while they were pregnant. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, homicide is the leading cause of death among pregnant women in the United States. 77% of pregnant homicide victims are killed during the first trimester, meaning that they are killed early on in their pregnancy. Firearms are used in 70% of pregnancy homicides. These statistics are troubling to say the least. Not only is the life of the mother lost, but the potential future life of a child is taken away, all outside of the control of the woman who's pregnant. The fact that homicide is the leading cause of death above any complications or health-related conditions should be concerning to all of us. I do want to be clear, though. Abuse is never the victim's fault. Abuse is the fault of the abuser alone. We've talked about this before, but abuse is all about power and control. Domestic violence occurs within all racial, economic, educational, and religious backgrounds, meaning that abuse doesn't discriminate, and it can and does happen to anyone. If you know someone who's being abused and you want to support them, remember these things. Don't pass judgment or blame on the victim. Offer loving support. Abusers often try and isolate their victims. Do your best to stay in the victim's life however you can that also keeps the victim safe. And finally, you can help your loved one create a safety plan. We'll include a link to a guide for creating this plan in our show notes. Sarah Parks was a third grade teacher at Moscow Charter School in Moscow, Idaho in June 2009. She was 28 years old and she was 20 weeks pregnant with her first child. Sarah was born in Houston, Texas and grew up in Dayton, Texas. Sarah liked reading, shopping, watching football, and playing tennis. Sarah graduated college in 2002, and she taught in Texas before moving to Moscow, Idaho in 2005. Sarah met and married Silas Parks, but I'm not sure how the two met or how long they were together before they got married. It was clear early on, though, that their marriage was far from perfect. In 2006, Silas received a domestic abuse and battery charge after pushing Sarah down to the ground. It was actually a church counselor who was counseling the couple who reported the abuse after they saw Silas grab Sarah by the arms and push her to the floor. Silas didn't receive any jail time for this charge. Instead, he was fined. Silas had at least two more physical assaults against Sarah, and he was again charged with domestic violence, which he eventually pled down to disturbing the peace. Silas was also ordered to undergo domestic violence counseling. On June 24, 2009, at 7:48 a.m., a neighbor called 911 to report a fire at the home of Sarah and Silas Parks. When firefighters finished putting out the fire, they found a badly burned and charred body. The body was later identified through dental records as 28-year-old Sarah Parks. An autopsy was performed, and the coroner found no evidence of any smoke or soot in Sarah's lungs, meaning that she had died before the fire started. Sarah's cause of death was strangulation or suffocation based on hemorrhaging found in her lungs. Obviously, any notion that Sarah's death was an accident was quickly ruled out after the autopsy. And of course, the first person that police wanted to talk to was Sarah's husband, Silas. In his initial interview with police, Silas said he was at the gym on the morning of the fire. He said he left home around 6:45 a.m., and when he left, Sarah was sleeping in their spare bedroom. Incidentally, the spare bedroom is where investigators determined that the fire had started. According to gym records, Silas checked in at 7:39 a.m. This was strange to the investigators because Silas's gym was only a 3-minute drive from his house, so why had it taken Silas almost an hour to get from his home to the gym on the morning Sarah died? When investigators pointed this out to Silas, he changed the time he left home to 7:20 a.m. Police didn't buy what Silas was telling them. The fire had been ruled as an arson because investigators believed it was started in order to conceal Sarah's murder and to destroy evidence. And honestly, there were no other suspects for police. Silas was the guy in their minds. And Silas certainly didn't do himself any favors. Shortly after Sarah's death, Silas called the corporate office of the company he worked for to complain about being denied paid bereavement leave after his wife had recently died in a fire. Silas told corporate that his local manager had denied his request, although it's unclear why. Corporate promised to help get Silas his paid leave. But when they made a call to the local office, they found out that Silas had been arrested for the murder of his wife and unborn child. Silas was arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of arson on July 1, 2009. Idaho law at the time stated that embryos and fetuses were considered humans for purposes of the laws surrounding murder. Silas allegedly told his attorney that Sarah's death was an accident. He claimed his memory of that day was vague and he didn't really remember anything about the events of that morning. Silas said that he originally planned on sleeping in, but he claimed that Sarah wouldn't let him and kept nagging him to wake up, which frustrated him. At one point, Silas claimed he, quote, had recollections of seeing his hands around Sarah's throat, end quote. He said he tried to do CPR on Sarah, but couldn't revive her. Silas said at that point, he put Sarah on the bed in the spare bedroom and set the comforter on fire with a charcoal grill lighter before fleeing. Silas told this same version of events to a psychologist as well, except that he also added that Sarah had pushed him and may have hit him, so he hit Sarah back. Silas was eventually offered a plea deal for 2 counts of voluntary manslaughter and 1 count of first-degree arson. As part of his plea, Silas admitted to strangling Sarah to death and then laying her body on the bed in the spare bedroom before setting the bed on fire and then leaving. At sentencing, Sarah's mom read letters from Sarah's third-grade students, all of whom were deeply affected and heartbroken at the loss of their teacher. Silas asked for forgiveness and said he'd failed at his, quote, vows as a husband and as a decent human being, end quote. Silas was sentenced to 15 years for each manslaughter charge, plus an additional 5 to 20 years for the arson charge. In 2011, Silas filed a petition to withdraw his guilty plea or be resentenced. He claimed his attorney pressured him to take the plea deal. He also claimed his attorney didn't try to challenge the state's autopsy report by hiring their own forensic pathologist. Silas's petition was denied in May 2016. Silas appealed this decision to the Idaho Court of Appeals, who affirmed the judge's decision. The Idaho Supreme Court denied Silas's petition for review. If you've listened to our show or followed us on social media for a while, then you know how much we love today's sponsor, Spooky Babe Stickers. Spooky Babe Stickers is a vinyl and planner sticker shop owned by Kim, the OG Spooky Babe. Not only does Spooky Babes have the cutest spooky stickers, think Beetlejuice, Nightmare Before Christmas, the OG Friday the 13th, Halloween and Scream movies, and Mean Girls, she has a great selection of stickers just for fans of true crime. Spooky Babes boasts an amazing selection of vinyl stickers and planner stickers, and she's constantly adding to the collection. Keep an eye out every other Friday to see all the new items that enter the shop. Head over to Etsy and search for Spooky Babe Stickers. We'll also link her shop and her Instagram in our show notes. Make sure you follow her on Instagram so you get all the details about upcoming sales, exclusive discount codes, and sneak peeks for Spooky Friday drops. And our listeners and followers can use our special code WINNIE20 to save 20% on their order and receive a freebie sampler. 34-year-old Brandy Ibanez was the youngest in her family. She was born premature, so she'd learned to be tough from a very early age. Brandy and her family originally lived on Hawaii's Big Island, but they moved to Portland, Oregon when Brandy was in sixth grade. Brandy was half Hawaiian and half Filipina, and she was loved by everyone who knew her. Brandy was known for her big heart and how much she cared for others. She was an amazing mom and worked hard to support her two daughters, who were 9 and 12. Brandy moved to Washington State in 2013. She began a relationship with 34-year-old Richard Jacobson prior to the move, and he was the father of her two daughters. Unfortunately, Brandy and Jacobson's relationship was a tumultuous and abusive one. Jacobson cut Brandy off from being able to contact her friends, and neighbors said they often heard the couple arguing. Brandy's friends said that Jacobson was controlling and that he beat Brandy, degraded her, and made her feel worthless. In April 2022, Brandy called 911 after Jacobson grabbed her by the hair, pulled her off the bed, and strangled her until she passed out. Jacobson pled guilty to a domestic violence charge, and he was sentenced to 30 days in jail, which he'd already served by then. Jacobson was court-ordered to attend mental health counseling, and the judge granted Brandy a restraining order, which prevented Jacobson from coming within 500 feet of Brandy's apartment. But Jacobson was found at Brandy's apartment complex on September 5, 2022. He allegedly attacked a neighbor and was charged with assault as well as violating the protection order. He was held on $5,000 bail, but he ended up being released a few days later. Jacobson also had a conviction for third-degree assault after he'd stabbed a 15-year-old back in 2010. He was sentenced to a year and a half in prison for that assault. In mid to late September 2022, Brandy's family couldn't get a hold of her for about 2 weeks. They eventually reported Brandy missing, but it's unclear when exactly that happened. On September 19th, Brandy's two daughters failed to show up for school. It was around this time that police believe a pregnant Brandy was last seen alive. Sadly, the naked body of Brandy Ibanez was found by an off-duty Kennewick police officer in the Columbia River on either September 22nd or September 27th. I read both dates in my research for this case, so I'm not really sure which one is correct. Brandy's body had been weighed down with bricks, and she'd been wrapped in plastic sheeting and a comforter. An autopsy was performed, and there was no water in her lungs, meaning that Brandy was dead before she was dumped in the river. Brandy was between 16 and 20 weeks pregnant. Much like in Sarah's case, police were interested in talking to Brandy's boyfriend slash father of her kids, including the unborn baby, Richard Jacobson. Police learned from family and friends that the couple's relationship was an abusive one. They also learned about the restraining order Brandy had against Jacobson, along with his history of assault. Unfortunately, there was no sign of Jacobson or the couple's two daughters. Evidence found in Brandy's apartment led investigators to believe that her death wasn't an accident. According to detectives, Brandy's apartment was neat and orderly, as though it had been thoroughly cleaned recently. Police soon enlisted the help of the FBI to trace Jacobson's cell phone and find out where he was. Jacobson's cell phone pinged in Gresham, Oregon, about 3 hours and 20 minutes from where Jacobson and Brandy had been living in Washington. Jacobson was arrested in Oregon on a no-bail order on October 11, 2022. Unfortunately, it took 6 months for Jacobson to be extradited from Oregon back to Benton County, Washington. When Jacobson was finally brought back, he pled not guilty to second-degree murder on March 31, 2023. His bail was set at either $1 or $2 million, and again, I read both numbers in my research. Honestly, though, I'm not really sure why he was given a bail amount at all, because he was clearly a flight risk, so he should have just been remanded. But that's my own opinion. Police searched Brandy's car at some point and found a glove that tested positive for blood, along with small pieces of brick in the trunk. Investigators were also able to locate security footage from Home Depot on September 21st, which showed Jacobson buying trash bags, duct tape, and planter wall bricks. Those bricks matched the ones that had been used to weigh down Brandy's body. Police also got records from one of the couple's daughter's cell phones. The phone pinged near Columbia Park between 4:50 a.m. and 6 a.m. on September 22, 2022. The next day, Jacobson told his daughters that Brandy had left with some other man to do drugs. This was obviously a lie, as I couldn't find anything to suggest that Brandy ever used drugs or had a problem with drugs, not to mention the fact that she was pregnant. In any case, Jacobson packed up his daughters and they drove to Oregon to stay with his family. Brandy's daughters, who again were 9 and 12, were interviewed by investigators after their dad was arrested. They said they came home from school, although it's unclear what the date was, and they could hear their parents arguing loudly in their bedroom. According to the girls, their parents argued all night. The girls had to turn on the TV to drown out the sounds of their parents fighting, something they probably, sadly, did often. Even with the TV on, the girls heard bangs and thumps, and one of them said she remembered hearing what sounded like plastic breaking. Then she said she could also hear her dad opening his toolbox, and she saw her dad fixing a fan with some tape. Neither girl ever saw their mom again after that night. Jacobson's trial was supposed to start in May 2023, but I assume, since I couldn't find any updates about it, that it was postponed. We'll keep you posted on any updates in this case. Our final case takes us to Kamloops, British Columbia. We've talked about Kamloops before, but in case you're unfamiliar with the area, let me give you a little background. Kamloops sits at the two branches of the Thompson River, which is why it was named Kamloops. It literally means meeting of the waters. And although it's a popular tourist destination, it's also ranked as the 28th most dangerous city in Canada, according to Maclean's magazine. Kamloops is above the national average in their rates of homicides, physical assaults, and sexual assaults. Our case takes us back to 2012. Summer star Elizabeth Krista Lee Fowler, better known as CJ, was a 16-year-old girl who was a member of the Gitimax First Nation. CJ was described as a loving and caring person. Sadly, I don't really know anything else about CJ because there was so little information about this case. CJ had been living with her 20-year-old boyfriend Damian Taylor for about 6 months by December 2012. CJ's stepdad bought bus tickets for the couple so they could go from Kamloops to Terrace, which was about 12 hours away. Presumably unbeknownst to CJ's stepdad, the couple went to Terrace to sell drugs. The couple allegedly binged on crystal meth, and they were coming down from a high when they went to the hospital because CJ was complaining of chest pain. CJ was diagnosed with anxiety, but as part of her workup, she was given a pregnancy test, which is common for women before radiology or imaging can be ordered. If a woman ends up being pregnant, doctors don't let her undergo any CTs, x-rays, MRIs, etc. So CJ was given a pregnancy test and it came back positive. According to hospital staff, CJ and Damian were quote-unquote calm and content when they found out the news. CJ had actually been pregnant 3 months earlier, but she suffered a miscarriage. CJ texted her stepdad to tell him that she was pregnant and also told him that she wanted to find a job and get clean. The emergency room doctor later testified that hospital staff offered to get CJ some food and a safe room for the night, but CJ declined. CJ told the staff that her grandma lived nearby and the couple also had friends that lived in the Guerin Creek area, which I assume wasn't far away from where the hospital was. One of the nurses said she heard the couple arguing as they left the hospital together close to 3 a.m. The couple was headed toward Guerin Creek. A pair of dog walkers came across the body of a young woman while they were on their walk near Guerin Creek just hours after CJ and Damian had left the hospital. The body, identified as CJ Fowler, was found under a concrete block that weighed 56 pounds. Her cheekbone and jaw were broken and her airway was crushed. Her cause of death was listed as asphyxiation. And I want to give a trigger warning here because this next part is a little bit graphic. A forensic pathologist would later testify at trial that CJ had choked on her own tongue after it was pushed back by the piece of concrete that had been used to hit her. Her tongue became trapped in her throat. There was no evidence of defensive wounds on CJ's body, so investigators believed that CJ likely didn't see the attack coming and she was completely caught off guard. Police picked up Damian at a Greyhound bus station in Prince George. He was alone, and to investigators, it looked like he was trying to flee the scene of the crime. When he was initially interviewed, Damian said that he and CJ got separated at the hospital. Damian made his way to the bus station, and he assumed that CJ would meet him there at some point. Damien told police that he thought CJ might have gotten arrested after the couple left the hospital because she got into an argument with a quote-unquote street friend. After searching Damien's backpack, police seized an SD card which they believed came from CJ's cell phone. They also found socks stained with blood, which they later matched to CJ. Police found CJ's cell phone on the rooftop of a hotel that Damien had stayed at for the night. But it would take another 2 years before Damien would be arrested. Meanwhile, police were building their case against Damien. It was primarily circumstantial evidence against him, but police had the surveillance video of the couple fighting as they were leaving the hospital, they had the socks stained with CJ's blood, and they had CJ's cell phone. When Damien was finally arrested in 2014, he claimed he didn't remember any of the details of what happened to CJ because he blacked out after smoking a bunch of meth. Damien also tried to commit suicide after he was arrested, and he remained under suicide watch for a quote-unquote significant period of time. 13 months after his initial interview with police, Damien had a new story to tell. This time, he claimed he killed CJ by accident. This confession came after hours of questioning and after CJ's stepdad was brought into the interview room. Damien told police that he was, quote, trying to scare CJ in a funny way, end quote, and ended up cutting her throat. Because CJ was allegedly bleeding from her throat, Damien decided that he was going to use some boulders that he found to, quote unquote, end CJ's suffering. But what Damien told police didn't fit the evidence or the autopsy. In total, Damien gave 3 different versions of what happened to CJ. Damien claimed he initially lied to police because he was high on meth and he didn't want them to search his backpack for drugs. Damien went to trial on second-degree murder charges. His defense attorney claimed that Damien was suffering from psychosis and paranoia as a result of the couple's crystal meth binge. Throughout his trial, Damien claimed that CJ was the quote-unquote love of his life. A motive for CJ's murder was never given, making her death all the more senseless and tragic. Damien's trial lasted 2 weeks before the 11-person jury found him guilty of second-degree murder in October 2015. When sentencing Damien, the judge highlighted the fact that CJ's murder was a brutal and savage attack that was completely unprovoked and unexpected. Damien was sentenced to life in prison. He'll be eligible for parole after serving 12 years, which will be around 2027. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Please subscribe and leave a review if you like the show. You can email case suggestions or comments to truecrimecatlawyer@gmail.com. The links for our social media pages are included in the show notes. And if you want more content, head over to Patreon to join one of our available tiers. Finally, if you're interested in learning more about my co-host, you can check out her Instagram at WinstonTheCatPDX. Thanks again for listening and stay tuned for our next episode.